Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with composer and audio designer Adam Flingson. It's great to have a chance to talk with you. It's really nice to meet you.
Thank you so much. It's great to meet you too. I've been listening to your show for a long time. You've had so many great discussions in the past. I'm honored to be here.
Oh, thanks. That's so cool. Well, we've got a few things to talk about. Your new studio, Silen Audio, and this incredible project that you put together toward the end of last year that just got released. Your tribute to Super Metroid. And why don't we start with that? Because it's such a cool idea to kind of reimagine the music from Super Metroid. And so, like, what is your history with the game?
So it was one of my favorite games growing up. It's just really formative game that, you know, I've played and replayed and replayed many times. And one of the things I love about it is that it's one of the earliest games that I can think of that really establishes this sense of atmosphere, this sense of just living in this world. And, you know, sometimes there's quiet moments where it's sort of like quietly threatening. It's not like Mario where you're constantly jumping around. It's like you're creeping around. And from a musical perspective, I think that the composers on all the Metroid games are really great at setting this tone and setting this mood that feels alive and that you get to interact with, but it's vaguely threatening. I love the music of all the Metroid games.
What's really incredible about, well, Super Metroid in particular, but yeah, all of them, is they were working with such a minimal set of tools because there was so little space for music, and the sounds that they got were just so amazing. So was that part of what you wanted to kind of riff on with your album?
Completely. I mean, even if we go back to the first Metroid for NES, that was an even more limited set of tools. And, you know, they had these NES game chips. They're really just kind of, I mean, I love the sounds that come out of it, but it's a really kind of a clunky sound. It's big, tough waves. You could tell that they were influenced by movies like Alien or The Thing or something like that. You know, these slow, brooding sci-fi movies. But those scores have these kind of slow creeping chords and stuff like that. And you kind of can't do that with the NES chip. So the original composer, Hirokazu Tanaka, he was able to establish this sense of atmosphere using this really simple chip that to me was groundbreaking in the 80s. And then you fast forward a little less than a decade and the SNES, now this was cutting edge for its time, and they were using real samples, but they were the tiniest little slices of samples that were looping over and over and over again. So again, they're trying to emulate a traditional orchestra and emulate film soundtracks in a lot of ways, but with such limited tools. And to me, there's a charm to the technological limitation that was present at the time. I mean, I'm sure it was frustrating maybe to be a composer on the project, any era, the technological limitations become part of what we love about that sound. So yes, I was really looking forward to diving into the score as a, you know, really understanding it from the ground up, not just as a fan, but reinterpreting and learning the melodies, learning the chords. And that was a big part of my motivation in doing this project.
Thank you.
It's such a cool album. It's called Ceres Station, and it's available mm-hmm. on Bandcamp and a few other platforms too. Mm-hmm. So when you decided that this was what you were going to do, what did you do to kind of limit your palette? Or did you feel that you had to? Because this isn't like a faithful reproduction. I mean, it's just sort of a jumping off point.
Right. So it was during the pandemic, and so much of what I do is a collaborative thing. I'm very used to being in the same room with other composers or game developers and bouncing ideas back and forth. And this was in October or November, so it had been a while. We had all been stuck at home. I really wanted this sense of back and forth. And that's why I decided to write the whole thing on Twitch. It was live. Random strangers could watch me do the process. And I really wanted this sense of back and forth where they could, you know, tell me, was I going in a good direction? Was I not going in a good direction? And then another part of it was I'm always interested in breaking down barriers to entry. I think that sometimes when you're a student or you're a young composer, you can see these fancy tools. Sometimes I call them magic boxes that people have. And it can feel a little out of your grasp, out of your reach. And it can feel a little deflating, I think. You think, oh, if I don't have this $3,000 magic box, I'm never going to have a professional sound. So I use only free software. That was my hard rule. I couldn't do anything that cost any money. And I was just trying to teach people that you can do professional stuff. You can do high quality work using just the stuff that you can get on the internet legally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a limitation at first. I like making these rules for myself because it does guide the project in a way. But after a couple weeks of, you know, I had to forego some of my normal tools, forego some of my favorite ways of working. But after a little bit of time, it felt pretty natural, and I didn't feel limited at all.
Wow. I have never talked to anybody who created something live on Twitch in front of an audience like that. I think the closest thing was when Gareth Coker was working on a game in open beta, and mm-hmm. people were having access to the music almost as soon as he had written it. But to just kind of be creating it in front of an audience, it must have been kind of nerve-wracking.
It was. And I was also trying to talk through. I was trying to bring people in as much as I could. So every decision I was making, I was explaining it. And I think that was maybe one of the hardest parts of it, was just, okay, well, now I'm going to take this EQ and I'm going to do that because of this. And so it was constantly this process. Some people seem to really enjoy it. They would put it on while they're working on their own projects. And I would say the most nerve-wracking or the most self-conscious that I was is that when you make music, it's a slow process. It's not a fast paced boom, boom, boom thing. So I definitely was trying to keep it light and entertaining as much as I could, but sometimes you just had to slowly build a baseline or something like that. And, you know, that's the process. That is what it is.
Well, it's so cool. I mean, it's kind of like, I guess, going to a concert, like a jazz concert, where the musicians mm-hmm. are just sort of creating something on the spot, and it's never going to happen again that same way. So
right.
What did you do? I mean, were you recording everything at the same time so that you could have a record of what you had done?
Yeah. So I have it all recorded. I was uploading a lot of them up on YouTube. I was hoping that they would be documented on Twitch, but I guess they're not there, but I do have them. At a certain point, I kind of gave up uploading them. Maybe I'll keep going if people want to see the whole thing unfold. I have them all on my computer. One of the biggest things that happened, because, you know, as I said before, I was really interested in exploring the sense of atmosphere. And originally I was setting this thing out to be sort of an ambient, spacey, vibey sort of a thing. And then partway through the project, I was like, well, let's see what happens when you add drums. And when you add drums, it can instantly switch genres. It could be rock feeling song or orchestral thing. And I tried all that. And then I started to add some electronic and some hip hop drums. And that was when the chat just started to light up.
Oh,
people
wow.
were like, oh, that's cool. That's cool. So I didn't even, the album it just took a right turn. And that was entirely because of what people were saying. They were like, do more of that. And I was like, okay, yeah. And it was a lot of fun for me. And I'm really happy with the way everything turned out.
It's a great just sort of wash of sound, and having those drums just, it does, it gives it a real energy, and it kind of sets it apart from other kind of ambient spacey tracks, which is, that's really cool. Well, thanks. Your background is writing and producing hip hop. And so How did you get into writing music for media?
It took me a long journey up until this point. I started to make music on a sampler. I was literally just recording bits of old records and recontextualizing them and building songs like that. And it was a wide variety of different electronic music and hip hop that I was making. And then I was working at an independent record label and a record distributor. This is in New York City. I was young, in my early 20s. And that was when I was like, well, I make instrumental music. I love making instrumental music. Who out there in the world is making the coolest, most exciting instrumental music out there? And over again, it would be music for video games, music for movies, music for TV. So I've always been a person to sort of push myself close to the people that are doing cool stuff that I admire. And I made the decision I was going to move to LA. I was going to take some classes about orchestration and try to fill in some of the music theory gaps that maybe I had at that point. And then pretty quickly, I started working under big composers for AAA games, also movies and TV and stuff like that. And when you work under these composers, you're kind of just thrown in the deep end, sink or swim kind of stuff. I was expected to loop cues and create transitions and interface with clients, set up orchestras and orchestrate stuff and also write music. And after a few years of doing that, it was like, okay, this is where I need to be. I'm comfortable. I'm confident. I know what I'm doing. And I just love it. And I kind of never went back.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've heard similar stories from people that LA is really where you need to be to get the kind of connections, I guess, that, you know, lead to jobs and lead to other, you know, big projects and stuff. So
yeah, well, there's composers all over the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I do encourage people who can't necessarily drop everything and move to seek out the people in your town and in where you are that are doing cool music and doing cool projects, because I guarantee they're there. It did make sense. And there's, you know, I'm not going to lie, there's a ton of composers, great composers in LA, and that's why it made sense. But yeah, I think that there's great music being made all over the place.
Yeah. Well, one of your recent projects was additional music for Marvel versus Capcom. That must have been a whole lot of fun.
Yeah. So I co-wrote some songs with a great composer, Cody Matthew Johnson. And I didn't set out to do this, but it actually was similar to the Metroid thing in certain ways, because we were given the original songs, and these were NES and Super NES era songs. And we were basically told to modernize them, make them sound fresh, make them sound exciting. So, you know, we learned them. We wrote MIDI. We tried a bunch of different genres, added synths, added guitars. And it was a really, really fun, really positive experience. And, you know, there was a lot of back and forth between us and Capcom in order to get it to sound the way that they wanted. So lots of revisions and stuff like that. But in the end, I'm really happy with what we did.
Well, what's so interesting about it is, you know, listening to music from games of that era, the Dark Ages kind of, and, you know, they would have these samples that sounded like strings or sounded like brass. And that's what they really were trying to reproduce. But what's cool about the way so many synth sounds are now, they just kind of lean into the synthiness of it. They don't necessarily have to reference strings or pretend to be something that they're not.
Yeah, I actually think that there's a real charm that we all can recognize from, especially in the 90s and also the early PlayStation era as well, where some of these, you know, maybe they were doing their best with what the technological limitations they had at the time in order to sound like real orchestra. But now we listen to them and we can really hear the tools that they were using. But I think that there's a positive to that. And you'll see some indie games these days, which I think make the smart decision to lean into the fact that it doesn't sound like a real orchestra, but it does have a charm to the overall sound. So I actually really like that retro fake orchestra sound. I think there's a lot of room for fun in that world.
Yeah. And it sounds like that's a sound that really has intrigued you over a bunch of projects. I watched your making of soundtrack for Outreach, and just the way that you went in and after some research found all of these Soviet era synthesizers from the 70s and 80s. It's just, I don't know. It's really a cool sound.
Yeah. So Outreach was a fun project to work on. It was one that I spent a lot of time, a couple of years working on, off and on with other stuff as well. And it took place in a Soviet spacecraft in about 1982. So it was a really specific time, a really specific environment. And, you know, whenever you're on a project like this, you're just asking yourself, kind of, how can I get as close to evoking a feel for the world that the player is interacting with as possible? And I went through a lot of different variations. And then eventually I was like, all right, I'm going to do it entirely on Soviet era synthesizers. So I got some Soviet synthesizers. I made whole, you know, hundreds of banks of sounds that I could manipulate and that I could really just build from the ground up. I made string sounds. I made basses, I made, you know, brass sounds, and they're all just coming out of these two very basic, you know, late 70s, early 80s synthesizers from the Soviet Union.
Wow. How hard were they to track down? I mean, I know you can get anything on the internet, but it must have taken a few, I don't know, some time just to source them.
Yeah. So you can get anything you want on eBay, but there was, you know, I had to spend, I was basically PayPaling people in Belarus or Ukraine and hoping that everything would go okay, paying for international shipping. You know, one of them arrived with this like almost like a foam mattress sort of around it, you know, with tape. And then when I first plugged it in, I didn't get the right voltage right, because it's made for a European voltage. Luckily, I was undervolted, not over.
Oh, that's good.
So it didn't damage it. But I before I realized that, I was freaking out because the thing was playing, but it sounded terrible. And it was like this low frequency rumble. And I was like, oh no, I just spent, you know, a lot of money and it just shipped from the other side of the world and it's not working. But then eventually I figured it out and I was relieved once everything just kind of lit up and they sounded good. They sounded fine. I mean, there's still a lot of finickiness to them. They're temperamental. You need to let them warm up. You need to tune them carefully. And every now and then certain knobs just don't work. So you need to sort of work around that. But yeah, they more than accomplish what I needed them to for that project.
That's so cool. It must be sort of like nursing a really old Volvo, you know, just sort of babying it. And
I went to, there's some synth experts in LA, and I kind of, before I bought these, I asked them, you know, how do I get my hands on a Soviet synthesizer? And everybody to the person said, don't, you know, because they had seen them, they had worked on them, and they were just like, this is just a nightmare that you're wading into that you, I'm glad I didn't take their advice. But they strongly cautioned me against it. Yeah. It worked out.
Держимся за руки, смотришь на меня.
And now you've got a new project. You've launched an audio studio, Silen. And that's so exciting. I mean, I know what an integral part audio is with games. And I've talked with composers who work really closely with like the audio director of a studio, but it sounds like maybe that's not always the case.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we keep finding, and this is more with indie games and kind of medium-sized games, is that they get a little overwhelmed when it comes to thinking about audio with the level of care that I think every game wants. And one of the reasons that I sometimes see this happening is that we as a culture, we don't talk about audio as a storytelling medium the way we do visual arts or the way we do, you know, written arts. And in my opinion, it's no less profound, but it's no less, you can do all the same storytelling that you can do with anything else. You carefully introduce elements and then you change them, and the change implies growth or implies a journey of some kind. So I find that some developers, they know the importance, but they don't have the tools to tell audio stories the way they might visually or with text. And so that's really where we come in. We are here to help them tell their story. We're here to help them find the core part. Like, we'll look at the concept art, we'll play early demos, and we'll just be like, what is this game really about? Like, yeah, sure, it's about, you know, shooting aliens or something like that, but what is it actually about? And that's kind of something that we are always trying to find. And then once we find it, we always do, but once we find it, we just latch onto it. And it's like, okay, it's actually a story about loss. And so we're going to elevate every audio decision we can to elevate that emotional aspect of it. And then other things we're going to actually de-emphasize a little bit, where they're not as important for the core emotional arc of the story that we're trying to tell. So launching the studio has been a big journey, and we've been doing it during the pandemic. So everybody's working remotely, and we're getting it together. We're helping these medium sized and small sized studios just find the perfect audio for their game. It's been really, really great so far.
I bet. Game audio is just fascinating to me because it's like this world that you create with sound, and there's so many possibilities, I guess. And I think one of the things that gets overlooked sometimes is that not everything has to have a sound. And so you must have to have a lot of discipline to, you know, draw the line and say that's really too much because all these things are competing.
Yeah. So, you know, let me think of an example. Like, I don't know if you've played the game Ghost of Tsushima that came out a year ago. So that's a beautiful game, and it's meant to be beautiful. You're meant to just sort of live in nature and encounter nature. And for that reason, there's so many natural, there's birds and there's animals that walk by, and you hear the sound of the grass that you're walking through. So all of the audio decisions are meant to elevate the sense of natural beauty that's around you. And contrast that with the most opposite game that I could think of, a game like Dark Souls or something like that, where it's a cold, dead, you know, just kind of unfeeling, just oppressive world. And there are moments where, you know, animals might scurry past or something like that, but just because you see a bird on screen doesn't mean you need to make it sound like a beautiful bird. And if anything, that would be interrupting the emotional arc of the story in a game like Dark Souls. So yes, you need to de-emphasize and de-emphasize certain things. And sometimes you just don't even have it there, but usually there's a subtle thing to represent the bird, the animal on screen, but the footsteps of the metal on the stone, that's going to be a lot louder just because that feels a lot colder and tougher for that world.
Well, it sounds like there's just a million decisions that have to be made and a million times that you have to run through gameplay to see, to get the balance right.
Yep. We play them over and over and over again. And then they make changes on the game. So then we have to redo many decisions. And sometimes it takes some work in order to get it right. Sometimes you think you're on the right path and you put a few weeks into something in one direction, and then you realize, oh, we actually needed to have gone that way, and then you fix it. So it's definitely a process, and it's a back and forth. Also, it's not just like we are on our own. We're collaborating with the game studios, with the people who are also trying to make it the best experience that they possibly can as well.
So is the studio Silent, is that it kind of a, I don't know, an intersection, I guess, a nexus between an independent composer and the studio, or do you also write the music at the same time that you're working on the audio?
So I personally will write a fair bit of the music. We have some other composers on staff, and we have sound designers on staff as well. When need be, we've also sometimes bring in outside people. If the project is large enough and the time is such that we just need to have a lot of audio quickly, we have a pretty big Rolodex of amazingly talented audio people that we'll call on. So yes, I would say that we're not just a go-between. You know, our goal is to handle all the audio that we possibly can in a sort of holistic way and create sort of a central vision for the audio, so it doesn't feel like the sound designer's over here and the composer's over here and they're on different pages. We're all trying to unify the vision and make it work with the game. I mean, we're in support of the game's vision,
yeah,
ultimately.
One of the things I had never even heard of before was when Jason Graves was talking with Stephen Hoddy, who's the audio director for Polyarc, about their game Moss. And Stephen actually tuned the sound effects in Moss so that it would dovetail with Jason's music and not be jarring in any kind of way. And I'm wondering if you have had the opportunity to, you know, be that thoughtful and go that deep into your audio design.
Oh, very much so. Every sound design, every sound effect we do, if it has any musical content whatsoever, and even a regular drum, even a kick drum, usually has some sort of a frequency. So yes, we are tuning essentially 100% of what we need to do. And whether it means changing the music to fit the sound that's already there, or it's changing the sound, like you just said, to fit the music, yes, we're doing that. It's just a part of it. I mean, there are actually times where you want the dissonance and you enjoy the dissonance, and that becomes a decision in and of itself. But what I often say is that you can't not make that decision. It needs to be something you consider pretty much every step of the way.
Yeah, I've heard so many great stories about composers who are also the audio director, and they will hop out of their car to record a really interesting sound, or somebody's screeching brakes, or, you know, just great stories about how they got those samples. And I'm wondering if you can share any stories about how you got some incredible samples or sounds.
Sure. So I'll say that for sound designers, the kitchen is just the best. You can find almost anything you need. I mean, I'm being facetiously a little bit, but just a combination of things that are in the kitchen can get you 85% of the way there. But I would say, in terms of interesting things where we're kind of trying to unify the whole picture, we were recently working on a game where one of the main characters was an archer. And her whole world revolved around archery. She was raised as a young child shooting a bow, and this was just a central part of her personality. So naturally, we started to think about, what does it mean to pull a bow back? You know, what is the tension on the string when you pull it back and then you release it? There's kind of an explosion. And then when it hits the target, we give some sort of positive feedback if you hit your target, or negative feedback if you miss your target. And then we're thinking about, okay, well, how does that interpret itself in music and in other audio? So naturally, we were thinking about bowed instruments. We used a viola a lot because it's almost the size of a bow and arrow. And we also were playing really high up on the fingerboard because it was a much tenser sound, kind of like when you're pulling a bow back. And then we kept going. We started to bow everything we possibly could. We would bow pieces of metal, pieces of wood, pieces of stone. At one point, we actually bowed like with a cello bow, a bow and arrow. So we were bowing a bow. We got kind of a cool drone out of that. It was just kind of a scary noise. And one of the coolest noises we made, we bowed this heater, like an electric heater, and it created this kind of vibration, sort of rumble. And we used that for one of the head bosses that she was fighting. And it almost didn't even make that much sense at this point, because that boss didn't have a bow and arrow. So why were we doing it all to that degree? But A, it was a cool sound. And B, I kind of justified it because, like, we're in her perspective in this moment. And it's almost like, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So her whole world is a bow and arrow. So maybe just everything sounds somewhat like that to her in her mind. I don't know. That's maybe just a justification for using a cool noise. But that's kind of shows you the way we're thinking about kind of all of these projects that we work on.
Yeah. Wow. That is just fascinating. So ideally, I would imagine you have enough time to kind of experiment with the sounds and the music and kind of go down various paths and stuff. So how do you get started with a project?
So it usually starts with some piece of concept art. That's usually the earliest. I mean, we like to be on games as early as possible, just like what you said, so that we do have the time. There are times when we come in at, you know, the 11th hour and we're just doing our best with what we have, but usually as much as we possibly can, we like the breathing room. And I will just say, for a movie, you almost never have the amount of time that you do with a game. A game project is almost always much longer than a movie. Movie, you have just a handful of months to do everything. So that's one of the things I do like about video game production. You look at the piece of concept art, and some artist somewhere made a lot of careful decisions. And so you need to take all of that into consideration. How green is the foliage that you can see? How much light is coming out of the clouds in this world? You know, is there technology? Is it a future world? Is there magic in this world? You know, we're taking all of that into consideration, and we're immediately kind of categorizing these things. You know, what percentage of warm nature is there to sort of cold, you know, evil boss energy, you know, and how much, what does this thing sound like? What does this thing sound like? And we're thinking about that both from a musical perspective, but also just from a sound design perspective. So we're doing it all as quickly as possible. And then we begin kind of crafting demos, you know, whether they're musical sketches or whether they're early sound design demos of certain aspects and certain elements in the story and elements in the game. That's where the exploration comes from. But once we establish, once the demo idea, once the core gets established, which often at best can take a couple of weeks, a handful of weeks to really figure it out, then that's when we go, just like what I was saying with the bow, that's where we go all in this direction. Okay, we've got it. We're just going to do everything we possibly can to get sounds out of that idea. And we're going to go too far, and then we're going to walk it back a little bit. That's kind of our strategy.
Wow. Yeah. That's fantastic to have that amount of time, hopefully, to do that, kind of play in the sandbox and get everything exactly right.
That's the idea. That's always the idea. As much as we can play in the sandbox, we will be happy. And the project will sound better for it always.
Yeah, of course. How many people have you got, you know, on your like core team?
Right now, it's a small team. We just started. So we're about three people who work regularly or work full time. And then we have a whole bunch of freelancers who we will bring on for specific projects for our specific specific needs. We are growing. So I'm hopefully some of these freelancers, some of these people that we are contract employees right now, I'm hopefully that we can expand and they can be a bit more regular part of the team. One of my biggest goals in starting this company is, over and over again, I would be just kind of brought on as a hired gun. And when you're working on a game, you form relationships with those around you, whether it's the sound designer or the audio designer or something like that. And then when the game's over, that's it. The relationship's over. So one of my big priorities in this is to get a core team that I just trust, that they trust me. We all are working well together, and the projects can change, but the team is going to stay the same. And I think that there's a lot of value in that. So that's a big, that's what we're doing the best we can right now.
That's a, such a great idea, because then everybody kind of knows who's, you know, what the strengths and weak, and not necessarily weaknesses, but the things they love doing, as opposed to things that are not so much, or, you know, and there's unique skill set, so you can hit the ground running and get things going a lot more quickly. So
that's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And it's you know, it's been going really well. It was a gamble. It was a different workflow. I'd been an independent, you know, freelance composer for a while. So it was a new endeavor, but so far it's been great. And I'm really feeling good about some of the projects that we can't announce right now, but hopefully we will be able to soon.
Yeah. Well, it's been so interesting talking with you. And is there anything that I didn't get around to touching on that you'd like people to know?
If you're interested in checking out the website, it's Silen, silen.audio. And we love to hear about what people are working on, even if it's preliminary stages or late stages. We're excited about games. We're excited about people who are working on cool stuff. That's our number one priority in all of this. So drop us a message. Just let us know what you're working on. You can book a short little call if you want to talk to me. And then if you're curious to hear the Metroid music, you can check out my website. My name, adamfligsten.com, AdamFligsten. Or you can just search Series Station. You should maybe be able to find it. That's pretty much it, I think.
Okay. Well, Adam, thank you so much. It's been really, really fun talking with you.
Thank you so much. This has been great. I really appreciate it.